to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi, how are you all? Welcome to the fourth episode of the What Bitcoin Did podcast. Firstly, I need to apologize. Sorry, it's been a few weeks since the last podcast. I only ever want to do these interviews in person, and with Christmas and getting my mining operation live, I just haven't been able to find the time or opportunity to sit down with someone that I really want to have on the show. I have, though, completed two in the last couple of weeks, and this episode I have Mike Jones, who is the ex-CEO of MySpace and now the CEO of LA-based venture fund Science Inc. I first met Mike a few months ago. He had read one of my Medium posts and he tweeted me when I was actually on a plane from the UK over to LA, and he invited me over to the science office in Santa Monica. For full transparency, Mike and the science team were interested in having me trade a crypto fund for them. So I've been traveling back and forth for the last few months to figure out the details of this, which has now been agreed and the fund is now live. And in this time, I've also got to know Mike pretty well, and I really do appreciate his view on the market. With the podcast, I've always wanted to have a range of people from different backgrounds to ensure that the knowledge we have to help us guide our trades is as broad as possible. There are currently a lot of questions over crypto asset valuations. You know, are they overvalued, or even are they valued in the right way? We have so many with market caps of over plus 1 billion, yet most of these don't have working products or any form of revenue stream. And this is something I think is really important for traders and investors to think about. So with this, I felt that Mike would be really good to have on the podcast, as he has so much experience of investing in startup companies. And I've also seen him at work looking at crypto-based businesses and what the opportunity and valuation around this new model of startup should be. We all know that this market is highly speculative, and at some point we will have to move from speculation to some form of economic reality. I've personally been trying to take a more macro view when looking at my portfolio to ensure that my long-term positions are within those assets which are most economically viable. So with this interview, I think you're going to hear a really good viewpoint on the market, both the potential but the risks associated with this uncertain and developing model for valuations. In other news, my mining rigs are now live in Washington State, and I have been mining Bitcoin with my S9s. This has been a really cool extension for my investments and a nice way to hedge, especially this week when the market dropped, because I was still able to create new value within my portfolio. To add to this, I am also staking Zcoin with my Znode and NEBL with my Neblio masternode. I intend to continue to support my trading with these passive streams, and if you have any questions, then feel free to get in touch. I also want to just give a big shout out and thanks to my buddy Chad Lauterbach, which I may have pronounced wrong. He has been guiding me with mining, and he also flew out to Washington State to set up the rigs. And over the last 2 months, I have inundated him with questions over how it works and how to do it, and constantly questioning him. He's always answered everything and been super supportive, and I advise you follow him on Twitter. I will add his handle in the show notes. And also a thank out to my buddy Rich Roll, who provided the intro to Chad. In terms of the market itself, wow, we had quite the drop this week. My portfolio took a 50% hit at one point. Half of that's recovered. But my biggest lesson from last year was that we have to take the rough with the smooth, and we have to accept volatility. As ever, I really appreciate any support you can give to the show. If you want to leave us a review on iTunes, it helps with rankings. Hopefully you think we deserve a 5-star review. You can also follow me on both Twitter and Instagram. My handle is at WhatBitcoinDid. And you can also check out the website and sign up for the newsletter. That's at www.whatbitcoindid.com. I haven't posted an article for a while. I have been just so stretched with everything that's going on with the trading and the mining and the podcast. But my buddy Tom is coming on board next month to help, and I'm hoping to get 1 to 2 articles out a week. Lastly, please do share this with your friends or share on social media if you like it. It does really help. Okay, so now on to Mike Jones. Listen to this closely. He is a very smart investor, and his experience on how markets move and how these assets could and should be valued is something we can all learn from. I hope you enjoy the show. Please do reach out to me if you have any questions. I'm also always looking to have other cool people on. So look, if you're interested, please pop me an email and I will get back to you as soon as possible. Enjoy the show. Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me here in your office and doing this interview. We first connected a few months ago when I was on a plane over to LA and you contacted me because I think you'd read a Medium post and we've been chatting a bit. So thank you for coming on the podcast. I want to ask you a bunch of questions related to crypto and venture and how venture guys think about investing in this space.
Sounds great. So, thanks for having me.
Cool. So can you give me just a bit of your career background? Because the first thing I was aware of is that you were once CEO of MySpace. So can you just give us a background?
Sure. So, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I was born to kind of two entrepreneurs. And early in my college career, I started kind of building companies. And it was right at the time when the web was becoming something unique and special and eventually big. I've built two or three small businesses. The third one I ended up selling to AOL. I spent 2 years as a senior vice president at AOL, and then left, worked in private equity, running some different companies. And then I was recruited to go take over MySpace when they were facing these massive challenges from Facebook. So I've been both a kind of early stage, you know, entrepreneur to running some medium-sized businesses to then running a very large distressed company. And then subsequent to selling MySpace, I started Science with a handful of other great operators I knew as a venture capital and incubation firm.
And can you tell us a bit about Science, the background, what it's done so far?
Yeah. So we're around 6 years old, and we brought together a group of maybe 12 to 15 individuals that are really good at building and scaling companies. And our goal is to identify early talent, work with them on their ideas, you know, invest alongside them or less invest in them, and then hopefully realize the benefit through an eventual M&A and exit. So we're a great place to go if you're an early stage dreamer or entrepreneur that wants to build a business, but you really want strong team around you to increase the likelihood of your success.
And you've also now completed your first ICO.
That's right. So originally we had raised, you know, traditional venture capital and traditional LP capital, which is how you fund incubators and venture firms. And we use that money to build companies like Dollar Shave Club and FameBit and Hello Society and Mammoth Media and a whole large portfolio of nearly 150 companies that kind of worked here with us at Science. We started becoming interested in crypto 4 or 5 years ago. And then when 2017 happened, and at the early stages of 2017, we became obviously re-engaged. The market fully came back, and suddenly there was some incredible new innovation to work with. And as you said, we did our own ICO in kind of a unique securitized structure to create a new pool of capital to essentially build crypto companies.
And what, on a personal level, when did you first become exposed to Bitcoin, and when did you start to think it was something that you should be taken seriously?
So I saw it 4 or 5 years ago. I began buying, Bitcoin. I think a lot of my friends that I knew inside the gaming communities that had participated in World of Warcraft, gold, and different kind of digital goods, this was really natural to them. I wasn't as immersed in that community, but they kind of brought me into understanding Bitcoin. I think originally it felt like something that was novel. I think the more I understood it, you know, I think we all quickly come to the conclusion that there's Bitcoin and blockchain, and these are two different things. And we started understanding the importance and the impact of this new infrastructure, and then seeing these kind of unique use cases and eventually growing value of Bitcoin. And so I was exposed to it early. Depending on what you consider early, I was probably buying Bitcoin when it was in the teens, I kind of stayed with it. When I first really understood it was right around the time before the Mt. Gox debacle, and we had really focused Science on it. So what's nice about Science is I have this great team around me and I have ready capital. So when we find something we love, we can go really deep. So we did find it. I did catch that bug that everyone catches with this sector. And I did push Science deep into crypto. This is quite a while ago. The problem was, there was not a lot of legal framework to work with. We had a hard time finding banks. Venture capital was really wary of it, and the legal landscape of whether you could own or trade this was very complicated. So 4 or 5 years ago, we basically decided that I would quarantine my Bitcoin enthusiasm to owning Bitcoin and not building things within the ecosystem. And obviously that changed last year.
What was the kicker last year? What happened? Was it just the explosion of everything, or was there a specific thing that changed it for you guys?
ICOs, I think, probably easily changed kind of everything. So, you know, between the time of Bitcoin crashing from its peak of, we'll call it $1,000 down to wherever it crashed.
250 or something, was it?
Right. 150 or whatever. After that happened, There was interesting, right at the point of that happening, there were two industries that were being really well-funded from venture capital. It was the Bitcoin blockchain industry, and it was VR. And after the Bitcoin collapse of price, the next 2 to 3 years, we saw this massive dry up of venture capital into blockchain-related businesses, and you actually saw it also into VR, where it looked like there were these two sectors that venture thought were going to be so exciting and sexy and consumers would adopt them, and it just kind of never happened. And so at a point, I'd be sitting with venture capitalists and they'd be like, oh, I have all this money locked up in these VR startups and I did a bunch of Bitcoin stuff and it never went anywhere. And it looked like there were just these two holes, of value that had been created. And then obviously, you know, January, February, March of 2016 comes around and suddenly ICOs just go bananas, right? So suddenly you have ready access to alternative capital. And so although there was a dryness of available venture capital in 2015 for blockchain startups, 2017, suddenly there's all this capital, right, being fueled by the industry that really was fueled because the price of Bitcoin rose, right? Suddenly the price of Bitcoin rose. Suddenly people that had a lot of Bitcoin wanted to diversify their crypto exposure into other crypto projects. You know, the Ethereum, you know, ICO or the Ethereum Foundation or the release of Ethereum tokens, that entire wave of wealth kind of washed over everyone. And then suddenly people wanted to put money into crypto. And so although the venture capitalist community at that point was not really supporting it, the internal crypto community did support it. And thus we saw all this development and all these new projects come to the world.
And having lived and worked through the early days of .com, you know, the first era, the first crash, how does the market now for blockchain and crypto compare to what you experienced back then?
So I was kind of graduating in college when companies were IPOing after their A round. And so so I wasn't quite in the middle of it. I obviously hear a lot of tales and I hear stories like, oh, you venture capitalists today have it so hard because, you know, we used to have full liquidity and IPO our businesses, you know, 9 months after they launched. And it was just this incredible moment. And then there was this obviously fury of the public pouring dollars into this stock market. But I wasn't really one of those companies. Like back then I was building products, but I wasn't raising money from venture capital. And I really wasn't aware of, you know, of how you could IPO a business. So I never saw it. But as I meet with people who are legacy investors that really live through that, they certainly draw a lot of similarities to that fury as now, where you have a lot of public capital going into companies that they may not completely understand. And those companies have promising new innovative technology, but maybe no actual customers or revenue. And so there's just a ton of obviously speculation around these technology companies, and the valuation slash the market caps of their tokens are extraordinarily high.
One of the things that I kind of theorize around this that is that even though these valuations are really high, that because of the speculation and the opportunity to make money, it then drives innovation. It creates a race to create the best product. So when the first .com crash happened, out of that became some really exciting businesses. We have Google, we have Facebook. So is it such a bad thing that this happens, or do you see it as a good thing? What's your kind of view on that?
Well, I think in a very long-term view, you know, certainly there will be great technology companies created through this entire wave of ICOs and tokens and blockchain. Maybe a lot, right? One problem is it's a little hard to know who they're going to be. The second piece is it's a little hard to know what the trough looks like and how long you'll be in that trough, right? So a very conservative investor could say, let's wait for the shakeout to happen. I'll buy back in the trough after all the speculative investors leave. I'll come in with conviction, and then I'll wait for those companies to become great. And I haven't actually mapped the, like, what was the peak of Yahoo, what was the trough of Yahoo, what was the subsequent, hopefully, peak of Yahoo, what was the eventual exit of Yahoo, like, if that was one company that weathered that storm, and or Google, or whomever you kind of put in that bucket. But I certainly know that, yes, there would be great companies, and on a very long perspective, you would hope those companies have tremendous amount of value. One thing that obviously must cause everyone pause is that some of the companies we're seeing in crypto are valued more than some of the greatest companies that we see in tech, right? So you have to then have a very long view that some of these companies will be greater than their current kind of peers. That is one framework. The other framework is also that you could say we as investors have a hard time separating commodity token value from equity value. We kind of talk about it as one thing. Like, it's funny that we talk about these things as market caps. Like, market cap for me typically means like the total enterprise value of a company and what it might be acquired for. But these aren't really market caps. These are like the total value of the tradable commodities. And they might only not even be the total tradable commodities. It might be the total value of the currently traded commodities and not the entire future to be released traded commodities. So the other thing that I wrestle with is it just may not be an apples to apples comparison.
Right. So actually, the market caps could be misleading anyway.
It could be misleading. I mean, for instance, you could say if Facebook's worth X, but every like on Facebook is worth, you know, 0.1X. Well, there's certainly way more likes on Facebook that at 0.1X than the total enterprise value of Facebook. And if you somehow put a value on those, you know, 0.1X likes, then suddenly maybe it would look like a different, you'd have to value it differently.
So we don't really have an economic framework to work here then.
Yeah, the only ones I can get around are like maybe, you know, real estate management companies that have portfolios of property and the property has a fluctuating value, but the management company has a set value, or physical mines that have speculative commodity value in gold or silver, or speculation of oil wells where there's a value of the company that owns the rigging that drills the wells and the speculative value of the oil that will come out of the land that they're leasing to drill the wells. You know, but in technology, I've never had a look at a company where I'm like, oh, here's the value of the company and here's the prospective value of, for instance, a giant patent portfolio or IP rights. Like, I just typically don't value the companies that way. Venture capital has a hard time looking at companies that way, as there's this secondary pool of value. And now these companies have a potential secondary or an actual secondary pool of highly liquid value.
And there's almost, with some of them, two ways to value them. You value the business and you value the token.
Right. And the thing that I also wrestle with is as somebody who's, you know, made a lot of capital and driven a lot of returns out of the equity value of these companies, I have to start asking myself, well, you know, do these crypto companies have equity value? And what does it mean for them to have a massive amount of token liquidity? And also, what does it mean for the management and the staff of that company if they're not really aligned to equity value, they're really aligned against token liquidity and token value? And then also, how do you incentivize them over a long period of time if suddenly you have people that have amassed a lot of wealth through these tokens, even if they haven't built a functional or valuable company? So it changes a lot of things.
Do you think they may not even need an enterprise value?
I think it's, I mean, it could, you could, I would have a hard time actually stating this, but you could say that maybe enterprise value is an antiquated way of looking at company value. And in a tokenized world, which is also a very broad statement, but in a company where there's token value, does the enterprise value even really matter, right?
And are there things in this that are therefore worrying you, or do you just see it as a new model that's being created that we're all kind of learning on the job, as they would say?
You know, I oscillate between those two things. So there's certainly times when, you know, I can convince myself this is just a big overvalued dot-com bubble. There'll be a massive shakeout and people will go back to aligning things the way they are previously. On the flip side, like, sometimes you're like, gosh, maybe this is something really fundamentally different and we have to think about value differently and we have to think about, you know, value creation and employee engagement differently. And I'm not sure.
And so therefore, are you bullish?
Oh, I'm bullish. It's exciting. And it solves, you know, certainly the token framework solves a lot of interesting problems that technology is locked up on. So from an alternative viewpoint, right, you'd say one of the reasons why the West Coast, in particular Silicon Valley, has benefited from such great innovation is because they have such great readily accessible capital, right? You have all this venture capital. And even the companies that we build in LA, most often than not, spend their time in Silicon Valley raising money from the Silicon Valley giant VCs. And that provides the United States and us a lot of potential benefit because we create, hopefully, great, useful companies that drive our lives to be better in some more efficient way. There's a lot of places outside of Silicon Valley where they don't get access to that capital. which is why, you know, Silicon Valley is a very unique entity, because they've really trapped up a lot of innovation simply because they have the capital to empower innovation. You know, if I was a country that was not the United States and I wanted to drive innovation, and suddenly I have a totally alternative way to raise capital to allow engineers and developers and entrepreneurs and dreamers to build new companies, this becomes really intriguing to me, because it's kind of unlocked a bunch of power that was sitting inside Silicon Valley, right? So I get excited about that, because it means that there might be ideas or concepts that previously weren't, you know, within the very small, tight-knit club of Silicon Valley that can now be explored and developed through these alternative capital sources, which is should be exciting for all of us.
Has this had, like, around the people you know in the space, has this had any kind of ripple effect on venture capital? And is this effect, is there less opportunity now for, or less deals for venture capital because tech guys are moving into crypto and blockchain?
I think you have a bit of a, I wouldn't even say a split, because that would somehow infer it was 50-50, but let's say you have a fractioning where you have certain people in venture capital that are very excited about it and spending time and deploying capital inside the framework of tokens and trading and you know, investing in these companies. And then you have a large portion of venture capital that I don't think is yet ready for it, and they understand equity. You also have a lot of very unique legal issues around how a venture capital firm might be formed and what they can or can't put their money into that may or may not prevent them from actually buying and owning tokens inside these startups, which again provides kind of an opportunity to other countries that may want to drive innovation. So you definitely have a fracture between people in the venture capital community that support and really want to build here and other ones that really just don't see the value of it and want to stick within equity investments. For the people like me, where I'm looking at companies now and I have some level of capital, and granted my capital is compartmentalized between kind of equity capital versus token capital, it's a little simpler, but in the realm of somebody cutting a check, so if you're an angel investor and you're used to cutting checks, and you can now cut an angel check, or you've been cutting angel checks forever, like I've cut angel checks forever where I give somebody between $50,000 and $250,000, and I might wait 5 to 7 years to see that money ever come back. 80 to 90% of that capital goes to zero because startups fail at a high frequency. And then the ones that come back hopefully make up for all my losses and give me some level of gains. And now I can take that angel check and I can give it to somebody that's doing a token or invest in a token. Whereas now I'm getting, in theory, you know, highly appreciating tech exposure to a new and emerging startup with immediate optionality and liquidity. Right,
so you can go in and out of the project as and when you want.
Right.
Okay.
It also means that capital that I may not have previously wanted to put into early stage tech, I now might be willing to do it because I no longer feel like I'm signing up for a 5 to 7 year lockup. I actually have some level of optionality.
But when you're raising money through venture, you get a lot of other things apart from the money, right?
True.
Whereas you're raising money through an ICO and you haven't got any investment in the background, this must be things you're missing as a team.
I think it depends on the team. You know, there are certain industries that you might need to navigate that are complicated, require, you know, historical relationships and a lot of structure and governance and oversight and guidance, and you might need to transfer stuff. There's other industries that you might not necessarily need that. So just as I wouldn't say every entrepreneur would benefit from a great board, I would also not say that every ICO benefits from not having great advisors and board members and structures around them, right? It's just going to depend on the team and the thing that you're going after and whether or not those people help. But certainly venture capital / standard corporate framework generally, I believe, helps companies progress in the right direction, helps management, helps navigate complicated issues, helps preserve and grow shareholder value. So generally, we've come to the acceptance that that's probably a good thing. And obviously, within the ICO framework, you typically don't have that.
So so the science fund, does that bridge that gap then?
Well, it could. I mean, the science, the capital inside the science blockchain vehicle can be used to help companies navigate the ICO landscape. It can be used to, incubate companies from start to scale. So it can be used for a lot of things. And generally, as in myself and the team that I surround myself with, I feel like we're good at what we do. We certainly don't need know anything. And we're very good at understanding how to build and launch products and navigate, you know, complicated BD deals and growth and all the kind of things that go along with it. So I generally like to believe that when we get involved in something, it's more than our capital. And that's probably true over half the time. There are certain times when maybe our capital is the only value that we can bring, which is fine too. So yes, like if there's a startup and they're looking at navigating this, whether it's equity or an ICO kind of blockchain strategy, generally I believe that we add a lot of value to that discussion with them.
And are there any specific areas within blockchain that you're looking to move those funds into, certain types of companies or projects? What are you interested in?
Well, so, you know, first and foremost, we're very good at consumer. We understand mass consumer adoption products really, really well and getting things in the hands and used by millions of people. So I think we're great at that. The second piece is I think that there's a logical use of blockchain where you have, you know, this need for kind of, user-controlled data, maybe certain levels of anonymity, maybe certain levels of obviously transferability with some level of irrevocability. And so that might manifest in something like people's credit scores, right? It's a very easy example. You know, I think it makes a lot of sense that my credit score should be owned by me and stored someplace that I can give someone else access to. I really don't like my credit score to be owned by Experian or a corporation. That feels odd to me. And now in a lens where you suddenly can have these kind of, I mean, autonomous data pools that are not controlled by a singular company, I start thinking to myself about the things that represent me or the things that I own and how maybe I don't want that ownership or that identity of mine to be managed by a corporation. And maybe that would be better if it was an autonomous data pool that I have some level of control over. And that would be a great project, right?
Right. And you see, so if anyone is working on those kind of projects, should they be getting in touch with you?
Oh, 100%. Listen, I think we're interested in the space and we're deep and we look at tons of deals and we know a ton of investors in the space. And I think we have a good sense of what works and doesn't work. So there's very little we don't want to see. You know, when we immerse ourselves in an ecosystem, we want to see it all. So I don't think we're going to be the best people to evaluate some depth of technology or cryptography. We're not going to bring that level of technical expertise. But when you're starting to think through the way you might structure an ICO or structure an offering or making sure you can navigate the complicated regulatory environment, if you're thinking about talking to investors, rolling out a product, getting it to consumers, hiring staff, building teams, like we're great partners for that.
And what were the things you learned running the ICO?
Well, so we chose to do a Reg D exemption to the SEC's kind of guidelines, which basically means that we are falling under this thing that everyone's calling a security token. You know, Blockchain Capital did this as well. It provides a lot more restrictions relative to the way the tokens can be sold, you know, and transferred, which basically means like you kind of can't discount them. You can't discount them. There are certain restrictions over how you can transfer them. You have to have accredited investors that can actually purchase them. There's a ton of disclosure on how they work. And the reason why we chose this is, first off, you know, we are setting it up much more like a fund, and we needed some very specific provisions that work with it being a securitized ICO. That's one reason. But the second reason is that I think in the future, you know, everyone's exploring the utility ICO so effectively, and there's all these great utility tokens with lots of usage. But I think there's this other world on kind of securitized, tokenized ownership that could be really, really fascinating. Whether it's touching a vehicle like ours or it's touching the ownership over your car, I think it's super fascinating. And so we wanted to go through that process. We went through that process. It's very complicated and very expensive, and I don't think it's right for many of the ICOs we see. But we chose to do it that way, and I'm happy we did, and we had a good result because of it. And I think it actually gave us more experience on how you will structure ICOs, even in the utility realm, but you'll be safe from hopefully future scrutiny from the SEC.
And you see ICOs as just now a new way of raising funds, and this is just going to continue and grow.
I mean, I think it will continue, and I'm assuming it will grow. I'm not sure it will grow. It could restrict. I think that we'll probably generally see probably fewer of these. I think they will probably be bigger. The same way that often in venture capital cycles, you first see a ton of when a new thing happens, like when everyone became connected to the iPhone, and everyone and your brother wanted to create an app, and suddenly all these individuals were funding these tiny little app projects to create the next big app. There was almost too much being funded on too thin of a basis, and then over time it started concentrating. Right, so it's very possible that we see ICOs will continue, but they may concentrate to much larger, more substantial ICOs with more structure and kind of formality around them. And some of the small ones may just not exist the way they do today.
So you see ICOs potentially being adopted by traditional mainstream companies as a way of raising funding?
I think there's. I mean, listen, we talk to traditional mainstream companies, we talk to public companies, and we talk to large private companies. And we talk to companies about acquisitions that want to use ICOs as an alternative form of capital. So everyone's thinking about it. Like, no one's not paying attention at this point. Everyone's paying attention. There's too much capital flowing in here for them not to be aware. I think we're all still trying to figure out the right use case. And there's quite a few use cases that we don't have a pioneer in yet. So people need to kind of bust through the wall first to show us the way to get it done.
Cool. Okay. So most of the people who listen to my podcast are traders. Most of them are interested in specific projects. I think it's going to be really interesting to get your take on a few. I'm going to talk about a few.
Yeah.
The first one I'm going to put out there is Ripple, because we've spoken about Ripple. Look, I know your views on it, but Ripple is a project which has twice now had a huge growth in the value of the coin. The XRP token hit like nearly 350 this week with a valuation of, well, on that market cap thing we talk about, like 125 billion. And I think one of the guys owning owns 60% or something, and he's worth like 55 billion. So the numbers are kind of crazy, yet there is a question over if there's any intrinsic value to the XRP token. So can you give me your take on Ripple?
Well, so yeah, Ripple is a funny token, because I definitely find that we talk to a lot of people about it, and there's very, there's very opposite opinions. You know, I know a bunch of the Ripple management, and I know a bunch of the Ripple investors, and the CEO of Ripple is a fellow named Brad, and he's a really good, solid CEO that's been in the industry for a long period of time. And generally, if you'd come up to me and said, "I've got this, you know, well-funded startup run by your friend Brad, and we think it's going to do great," I would generally be super supportive of that, because I think he as a CEO is actually a really great CEO. And I think if we looked at the management, we might be super pleased. On the flip side, the crypto community has very, different feelings on whether the value of the XRP token is right or not, and whether they do or don't adhere to kind of formal blockchain principles. And I can't really speak to that because, you know, to be honest, like, I have not looked at the Ripple code set. I don't think I'm technically astute enough to really tell you why they are or are not following decentralization. What I can tell you is that if there's banks and those banks want to work with blockchain and they can get the CEO of Ripple on the phone, I think he will do a really good job at convincing that bank to work with him, because I think he's a very good CEO. And I think he will attract people that will trust him. And I think the venture capitalist names and the equity they've raised will further encourage large corporations to want to do business deals with Ripple. Now, I have no idea what the right price of a Ripple token is. So from a business perspective, I'd say that's a good team, and they should be able to do big projects with large corporates that will feel very comfortable working with that management group and that equity in that venture capitalist group. I have no idea the right price of that token, or the token concentration, or the ethics around the token concentration or individual ownership. I have no idea.
What about Bitcoin itself?
So, I mean, I think, you know, I think Bitcoin is here for a long period of time. I think it's, you know, obviously the most well-known brand at this point. It's funny that it has kind of no CEO, right? So I heard an argument recently that Bitcoin would be worth a lot more if it had a management team that was helping promote the use of Bitcoin inside of countries with highly inflating or deflating currencies. So I think that people trust Bitcoin. I don't know the right price of Bitcoin, the same way I don't know the right price of gold. But I do think that there's a lot of people all over the planet that may want to store their value into a digital product. I think right now they're going to choose Bitcoin. I think that, you know, for them to choose Ethereum feels weird to me, because Ethereum to me truly does feel like an application platform that we can all build upon, and we're building companies in essence on top of Ethereum. We're not building companies on top of Bitcoin, and that's okay, because I don't know if I want to build companies on top of money. And if Bitcoin is being used as a store of value, even everyone doesn't think that's the sexiest use of Bitcoin, but if that's what we're telling the public, that they should store value in Bitcoin, and oh my gosh, you're in Venezuela, you should buy Bitcoin, and that's what the public message is. I don't think we also want to say, oh, and I'm going to build my application on top of your money. It just maybe kind of feels weird. So I think the public likes to have things in boxes. And if you say this thing over here is where you can store value, and this thing is where you can build things, and this thing is where you can transfer things, they generally like that. And so I think we'll continue to see people wanting to own Bitcoin. I have no idea what it means with whales dumping and hedge funds coming in and individuals pouring in dollars. Generally, it feels to me like I would speculate over the next year there's more money that wants to enter this ecosystem than wants to leave the ecosystem. And just from all the people I know, or we all collectively know, that are raising funds to get exposure to this asset class, they're probably going to enter through Bitcoin. So I would expect a lot of money to flow into it. If that changes the price, I guess we'll have to see.
And is it mainly Bitcoin they're going into because it has the liquidity they require or safety? Why would this institutional money pick Bitcoin?
Well, I think that there's certainly a market cap component to it. So I've talked to, you know, I've talked to large LPs, and I said, look, we should really get you into crypto as an exposure to, you know, exposure asset allocation to crypto. And they'd say, well, what's the market cap, right? And I might say, well, the entire crypto market cap, let's say back then it was 600 million or 700 million or 700 billion. Right, what they might say is, you know, it's just too small of a market cap, right? So, right. You know, you always forget that there are very wealthy countries and institutions all over the world, and they pour a lot of money into different markets, and they generally want to pour money into very big markets because they never want to be a large percentage of any single market. That makes them very nervous. It's too concentrated risk. So yes, I think there's one component that the bigger Bitcoin gets, the more comfortable large institutions will be in pouring in money. But there's also the second thing that's much simpler, which is that people know the name and they know the word and it's being spoken of all over the place. And it's more likely that they will start there just because of brand recognition.
So actually the size of the market triggers more money to come in.
Yeah,
wow.
That's exactly right.
And do you have any views on the scaling issues? Do you see Bitcoin Cash as a good thing that accompanies it, or do you see it as a threat? Do you have an opinion on Bitcoin Cash?
I don't have a distinct opinion on it. I think it's just, I don't like the confusion in the brand. So as somebody that wants to see this ecosystem grow and flourish, I don't like the fact that someone's going to come up to me being like, Mike, should I buy Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash? And I don't like to have to explain that to them. And I don't think they like the fact that there's two different prices. So I think that's a bad idea. Right. You know, I understand why it's done, and I generally understand that the reason why there's a technical split and why there's this fork, and I understand this, but do I really want to go to explain that to a family office that wants to put $100 million into crypto, how they split their value between Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash? And then I'm going to talk about what the fork of the code and Roger Ver and the block size. These are things they really don't want to hear about, right? And so I think.
But don't you find yourself talking about this all the time now?
Well, now I have to talk about it. Like I, it would be easier if I didn't have to talk about it, you know, because I wouldn't have to explain it, right? Because now it goes from complicated to just more complicated, right? Like, so if I told you, well, you should buy Apple stock, it's great. You're like, oh, that sounds great. Well, should I buy Apple stock or Apple iPhone stock or Apple iMac stock? I'm like, well, the Apple iMac stock is run by miners, but the Apple iPhone stock has an unlimited supply. And there's this one guy that split the Apple iTunes stock into iTunes A and iTunes B. And the iTunes A only has 3 megabyte songs, but iTunes B has 10 megabyte songs. So you choose. You know, you're like, yeah, you know what? Maybe I'll just go buy Google. You know? I'm not sure everyone realizes it, but as much as we all get into this technology and these nuances, a normal person approaching the market, now they have two choices versus one. It just makes it a little bit harder for them to understand.
Right, okay. I've not heard that analogy. That's great. Okay, so we talked. You mentioned Ethereum, so you like that as a project?
Sure.
Okay, what about the other protocols? Because we have EOS, we have Cardano. I mean, there's a lot to keep up with,
yeah.
And a lot of them have very high valuations.
Yeah.
Without really any working product. What do you think about the multiple protocols? Do you think the ecosystem can support it? Do you think they will consolidate?
Yeah.
Anything you specifically like?
Well, so I can only draw parallels back to internet protocols. And so I know that the internet runs off of a lot of different protocols, HTTP, FTP, you know, whatever IP addresses, DNS servers. There's a whole bunch of protocols, right, that we use to run the internet. And they all kind of have different uses. And then there's also all sorts of programming languages that you could choose to write whatever application you're going to put through HTTP or through FTP or through SMTP in order to write the application that run on top of the protocol. I would imagine this should look similar to that, where there will be a series of widely adopted protocols, and it'll be Betamax versus, was it VHS?
VHS, yeah.
And then VHS1. And so overall at the protocol level, assuming we're considering that a protocol, there will be leaders that will clearly be the dominant protocol. Then there may be lots of application languages to build on top of those protocols. Right now, it's a little funny because sometimes the application languages are protocols and sometimes there's not, so it's a little bit confusing. But I would assume that kind of all sorts out over time. So that's the first answer. The second answer is I have no idea the right value of those protocols. The only parallel that I can get my mind around is domain names. right? At some point, ICANN or whomever it was, Network Solutions said, congratulations, there's this free registry. You can register as many domain names as you want. Speculators believe that HTTP and DNS is going to be really important, so we all go and register all these domain names. Then suddenly people start building websites through a variety of different applications. They're running on top of the protocol of DNS and HTTP, etc. And then suddenly our names that we were sitting on, that we speculatively purchased, have a ton of value, and then we sell them for multiple millions of dollars. Right?
Right.
Maybe that's kind of a good parallel.
And are there any other projects out there that you like specifically?
I mean, we stay really close to the EOS team because we like them. We understand them. They're, you know, they have a presence in LA. We talk to their team, and generally, I'd say our engineers are very excited about what they're talking about and some of the test things they've seen. So we get excited about that, and we have purchased and we sit on EOS tokens, and I personally own EOS tokens because I believe in that team. You know, we, you know, although it's not a protocol, we really are in love with WAX. You know, I think that we know the management there. We're really excited about the size and scale of the OpSkins business. That is the kind of primary game skins trading marketplace globally. They're at a scale that's honestly, I wouldn't want to say publicly, but it's hard to comprehend how large they are. It's really a big surprise. And the fact that they've created their own globally usable token in WAX, to me, just becomes really exciting. And we own WAX. I will buy more WAX. I'm a big believer in that as something that is going to have a lot of money, I believe, will transfer through their token ownership, or through those tokens trading. So those are two things that we're very excited about. But, you know, luckily I've got a solid team of partners here that all have different positions and different tokens that they have kind of conviction around. And I try to stay a little bit, you know, autonomous to it and let them, you know, really get into the weeds on it.
And going forward, is there anything specifically that you think the market needs to approach, deal with, anything it needs to work on? Like, are there things specific for, like, I don't know, like security? We've talked about security.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a, you know, there's this, obviously there's benefits and negatives to this decentralization, public key, private key kind of wallet structure. I think for normal people, I believe most people have internal self-doubt, and they actually are more comfortable having other individuals or other institutions be a secondary line of trust and protection for them. I think they generally like that because they doubt themselves. I think it's really awkward for individuals to know that they could have this master private key that if someone gets a hold of it, they can be robbed. I think that's a really awkward idea for people. Now, I was thinking about it as like I remember talking to somebody, we do a lot of work in India, and I remember talking to somebody in India, and they were like, oh, it was like my grandmother. I'm like, oh, what's up with your grandmother? Like, oh, my grandmother kept all of her money in gold in her house, you know, and she had this place that she stored all of her money in gold. Her entire wealth was stored within her house, which is probably the way it used to be. Mm. And when everyone's storing their wealth in their house, they probably felt really good about it. They're like, oh, I store my wealth. Maybe I have a gun and I protect my wealth, and this is where my wealth sits. And then at some point, somebody creates a bank. And like, well, if you put your wealth with me, it's much more portable, and I can, you know, and I'll secure it for you. I would bet there's a lot of people right then that said, I'm not going to put my money into a bank. Mm. I don't trust you with my money. My money's in my house. I know exactly where my money sits. It sits right there. It's gold. It's under my floorboards. It's in my safe. Whatever. This is my stuff. But then there's all these, you know, young kids be like, oh, no, you got to trust the bank. You got to trust the bank. You got to put the money in the bank. It's so much better. It's so much easier. We don't have to worry about the house. We don't have to secure the house. No big deal. And now we're almost being like, why are you, your money's in a bank? That's crazy. Like, you put money in your wallet. And you all have private key. But what if I start? Oh, that's old thinking, right? So I think when you think about the protection of value, it probably started where it was highly decentralized. And then it moved to a very central infrastructure. And now it's moving out to a decentralized infrastructure again. And I wonder if the barriers are more cultural.
When they also, you've got people keeping their private keys in a bank, in a safety.
Right.
So you've got a decentralized...
Yeah.
Bank inside a centralized bank.
Yeah. And I have a feeling this will actually be one of those things that age will be the separating line. Like if you were under the age of 18 when you bought and held your first Bitcoin or ETH or any kind of alt token and you held it in your own managed wallet, you will think that's normal and you'll be very comfortable with it. But if you were probably over the age of 25 or 30 when you started actually managing your own stuff, I have a feeling it's always going to feel weird to you.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit, you know, I mean, you've got kids, Mike, I've got kids. Yeah. My kids don't watch TV on a schedule.
Yeah,
they watch on demand. They don't know of a time of no internet. So I guess it will be a cultural difference.
Yeah.
And what I've also noticed is the younger people I've been meeting, they feel a lot more comfortable with crypto.
Yeah.
It just feels something natural to them.
Which is funny because, you know, it is a funny thing. I think it's also because the stock market for most people, I think, feels very untouchable. It's hard to understand. It's complicated. It's ruled by all these people that we don't really understand. You know, there's puppet masters controlling it. There's all these rules and regulations around it, and people go to jail for it, and I never can really touch it. And suddenly there's crypto, which in a weird way is actually kind of easier to understand. I buy this thing. I have it in this wallet. I can move it over here. There's no one telling me what to do with it. I can give it to you. I can do all this stuff. So in a weird way, I think if you're not in finance, crypto is actually kind of understandable. Sometimes I wonder whether, you know, and I, you know, there's so many interesting origin stories around this entire marketplace, but part of me likes to think that there was a group of technologists that said, like, I don't really understand or care about the stock market, so I'm just gonna kind of build my own thing, you know? And so they kind of just did. They're like, this makes a lot more sense to me. And so it's like technologists just reinvented that world for themselves.
Yeah, and everyone's trading now.
Everyone's
trading now. I mean, I must speak to like 10 to 15 people a day who are just regularly trading, who are friends and family, and everyone's getting involved.
Yeah.
Okay, look, just a couple more questions. So, right, we've got a huge market cap at the moment.
Yeah.
750 billion.
Yeah.
We could go over a trillion very soon, or everything could tumble down.
Yeah.
Like, are there any specific things that you're looking at as key signals for kind of market sentiment?
I look at big headlines. Right. And I get nervous. I mean, I don't get nervous with the Jamie Dimon, or today it was.
Well, he regrets it now.
Sure. But like Warren Buffett today was, you know, some quote around Bitcoin will, you know, end in failure or something. But I look for, you know, I think there's certain headlines that will change public sentiment. That's something that I think we all have to just be aware of, because if public sentiment really turns, that'll be a big deal. The second thing is, you know, we have non-leaders, but leaders in this community. Like, they may not be our chosen leaders. They may not control, from an organizational perspective, Bitcoin. But they're definitely leaders in this community, right? And what they say is, you know, kind of matters. And, you know, how they position themselves and how they position the crypto community matters, right? And if they say the wrong things, it can bring a lot more scrutiny to what we're doing. And if they say the right things, maybe it can bring a lot more support. So I think you also have to pay attention to how leaders, just the same as you might think about the leaders of the stock market, are talking about the crypto world. I think that's important. And the third thing is, I think a lot about the historical public sentiment on this stuff. Like Mt. Gox feels like a long time ago for me, and yet it comes up so frequently in conversations with people that are new to the industry. Well, what about Mt. Gox? It's like, well, that feels like a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, that, and the other thing I keep getting is, like, you know, when large dollars are talking about coming in, they're still bringing up Silk Road and drugs. You know, and I'm like, oh, are we still there? Oh my gosh. You know, like, you're still thinking about that. When I say Bitcoin, you think drugs. And I'm like, huh. Because I don't think about that. Like, I think Coinbase, I think store value, I think GDAX, I think exchanges, I think networks.
3 years ago, maybe.
Yeah. And so what we forget is, although we've all been indoctrinated to this in a different light and we see it very differently, you know, people that aren't so close to this actually have these, like, historical stereotypes that are tethered to these, you know, to these words and terms, and it affects the way they think about it. And, you know, yeah, it would not be great right now to read about a giant drug raid that had the word Bitcoin in the headline. That would not be great for all of us, because I'm telling you, like, the general investing public does not feel super great if they're backing a currency that is being called out for illicit uses. Like, that doesn't make them feel good, right? And so, like, there's certain one of those headlines that I pay a lot of attention to. And then, of course, we've got lots of systems that monitor markets and movements and buy and sells and trades, and we obviously look at the correlation between alt tokens and ETH and, you know, and debt and, you know, Bitcoin and all these things to try to kind of understand. It definitely feels like a market that you have to pay fairly close attention to if you're active. There's no, you know, it's not like you can just buy five stocks and close your eyes. I think you have to either pick the right five things and close your eyes, or you need to be super active with it, right?
Right. And conversely, what are you looking out for as a bullish signal to see this market fly even further?
I mean, I'm excited for commercial use cases, right? So when I hear about companies that are like, we're about to announce that we have a substantial amount of customers that are transacting with our token for actual goods and services that have driven us revenue that will support our functional business, I get really excited about that, right? Because one thing I know is we've done an immense amount of startups here. And every time I sit in the initial PowerPoint pitch, it all sounds so exciting. And it's all going to be a monster, and it's all going to be the breakout company. And every CEO is convincing me of that first month's numbers are just going to blow it through the graph, right? But what I know is that on any company launch, the start will almost always be slower than you anticipate. It just always is, right? And as sad as that may seem, and even with Dollar Shave Club, billion-dollar exit, Unilever, complete breakout, viral video, I would even say that if I showed you the metrics of that company 2 months after their launch, and I told you, you need to invest in this because it's valued at $1 billion, there's no way you'd do it, right? And that is a full breakout company. So even in the view of a full breakout company, the early numbers are typically small and slow. And that's just the reality of the way companies work. And I know that because I've done a lot of companies, right? But I see a lot of blockchain startups that have these stratospheric tokens, and they're prepping for their launch, and they're prepping for their consumer adoption. What I fear is that the consumer adoption would be way slower than they anticipate.
Right. Okay. Cool. Okay. Like, just to finish up, what's the future for you? What's the future for science? Like, how can people follow you, get in touch if you want to hear from them?
Yeah.
Can you just give us some?
Sure. My Twitter's M Jones. I tweet fairly infrequently, sadly. science-inc.com is our website. There's an entities page that talks about our various kind of funds. I see every email that goes into there, so you can click on any of the contact links and it will probably come across my desk for sure. We have a news section there where we post official news, and because the Science Blockchain Vehicle is a Reg D exempted security, we post official news for the blockchain on the blockchain entity page. I'm fairly easy to get in contact with. We're happy to look at ICOs. Generally, when companies come to me, I'm looking at through three lenses. A, is it a company that I'm interested in the equity? B, is it a company that I'm interested in working with to build whatever that founder and that founding team's dream is? And C, is it a company that would be right for our ICO team to participate and purchase and maybe trade within? And so I'm looking for the right, kind of the right slot to put these companies. It's easier for me if you can tell me that when we start talking.
Right. And any closing thoughts?
No, I think it's an exciting time. It changes every day. And at least from my perspective, this is the place to spend time right now. Like there's really nothing more exciting happening, I think, than what we're seeing right now. And I'm open to it. And there's lots of time in the future where everyone can go get regular jobs. But right now, I think you've got to go all in on this because it's too amazing.
I completely agree. Great. Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I hope you all found that as interesting as I did. I have talked quite a bit on Twitter and to my private Facebook group that we do need to start thinking long term about the valuation of these crypto assets, because when speculation does end and the market starts testing these protocols and these coins and utility tokens to see how people will actually use them and if there's adoption, then economic reality will set in and prices could change quite dramatically. We could see some assets go up in value and we could see some fall dramatically in value, almost to zero. And I think it's so important that we all consider this when making our investments, because we are all here trading to create wealth for ourselves for the future. So I hope you really enjoyed that. I hope you took a lot from that. Mike is a really cool guy, and I'm really glad I've got to know him and work with his team at Science over in LA. Again, as I said in the show intro, if you want to support the show, please do go and leave a review on iTunes. It really does help. Please do follow me on Twitter or Instagram. Get in touch if you have any questions. I do try and reply to everybody. And I will be looking to have the next show out in a week. It's already recorded. I just need to get it over to my engineer. Okay, I hope you have a good week. Happy trading. And I will speak to you all soon. Take care.